G'day, Dr. Carl here. Back in 1986, I could not wait to see teacher Krista McAuliffe on the Space Shuttle Challenger launch into space.
Roger, Challenger. Obviously a major malfunction.
We could not believe what we were seeing. The Challenger Legacy. To hear more, search for science fiction and look out for The Challenger Legacy. Find it wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
Were you indulging so much over Christmas you feel you got to kind of pull back, Priya?
I feel like that now. I took a lot of January off. I feel like you've been watching me at home.
With a hangover or what?
A bit of a hangover, but I do feel I have consumed more alcohol over December, January than I do for the whole rest of the year.
Yeah, well, I think most people do.
Yes, and I don't sleep as well and I don't feel as great. But I don't do a dry month necessarily because normally I'm really quite careful.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people do dry July, don't they, in Australia?
Mm-hmm.
And there's this increasing tendency to do dry January. And I noticed a piece in The Atlantic on dry January being high January, which is a thought we should actually look at this week.
Yes, and I'm seeing ads on my social media feed all the time about it, so I'm very interested to know, is it actually a better option, THC versus alcohol?
That's coming up on the Health Report.
I'm Priya Alexander on Wurundjeri Land.
I'm Norman Swan on Gadigal Land. Also on the show...
Early palliative care can significantly improve the quality and length of life care, but most people are referred far, far too late.
In some parts of Australia, women are being notified of their breast density after a mammogram, but there's confusion about what they do once they're notified and whether they can do anything at all, in fact.
In the news, though, COVID hasn't had the normal Christmas spike that normally occurs, Norman. Is it good news?
It is good news. So going right back to the beginning of the pandemic, what was surprising in the first year of the pandemic is that everybody was saying, well, it's summer and people are outside, you're not going to see a spike over Christmas. And sure enough, we got a really big spike that first year, pretty big spike the second year. And there's been spikes in COVID every year, except this year, there's been no spike. And we'll have a reference to the New South Wales respiratory surveillance data on our website. But this is potentially really important. It's great news. But it suggests that maybe COVID-19, I hate to use the word normalized, but is becoming less of a pandemic virus, therefore around all the time, surging almost with a mind of its own, to being more a bit like flu, a seasonal virus. Doesn't mean it's a milder virus. It's just that it might not be there all the time in such numbers. So it's going to be really interesting to follow that during the year.
What has spiked during summer and caused issues, and I've seen this in the consulting room just before Christmas, there's been a lot of influenza around, which I think has been quite surprising for the warmer summer months. People don't usually expect it. And for the first 15 days of 2026, there were more than 7,000 recorded cases of influenza, which is quite new.
Yeah, and it's settling down now, according to some state data. But it was influenza A, a version of H3N2 called, that people are calling special K, or it's really
Super K. Super K is what patients called it, yeah.
Yeah, subclade A. It's not that it was a necessarily more aggressive virus, but it was evading the immune system. And it happened at a time when, I mean, people think that the influenza vaccine lasts all year. It tends to really only last for a few months and get you over Christmas. So that if you had been immunized, you were still getting some effect of it, but not full effect. And it wasn't fully covered by the vaccine anyway. So that was just an unfortunate situation. And it just shows that when a new variant of a virus comes out, it can break the rules in terms of seasonality.
And that's why there's a new flu vaccine every year. It does wear off after 3 to 4 months. So when we start talking about the flu vaccine in March and April, that's the time to go and get vaccinated.
And by the way, if you're feeling vulnerable to the flu, you can talk to your GP about a second shot.
You can. And there's also an intranasal. That's what I was trying to get to, the really exciting news, that this year there's going to be some states funding, unfortunately not my state of Victoria, but an intranasal flu vaccine for children is going to be available, which might just raise the rates of vaccination in kids aged under 5 because they're a really poorly vaccinated group at the minute.
And we're a bit late to the party on that because other countries have had the intranasal vaccine for some time. And while we're talking about infectious diseases, America may well be about to lose its status as having eliminated measles. Canada, interestingly, has lost its status as eliminating measles. There's been 336 cases this year so far. And one of the senior people in the CDC didn't seem to mind too much about it. He was saying it was a cost of doing business, quote unquote.
That's right. I think this is huge news, Norman. Like, this is losing your elimination status. So you're right. The deputy director of the CDC said, when asked whether this was a significant loss, losing elimination status, the quote is, "not really." They've said this is kind of the cost of business of having open borders and lots of travel. This is a country that at the moment in South Carolina has a significant outbreak of measles. More than 500 people are in quarantine because they've been exposed to the virus through schools or universities. There's more than 640 infections in the state, remembering that last year Texas had significant issues and death of an unvaccinated child with no underlying medical diagnoses. So, you know, this is scary stuff.
And it's not as if it's new that we travel. So we've always travelled and we've always imported measles cases. But what's happened is that because we've been well immunised, they haven't spread within the country. And that's the key. So it's a rather silly remark, to be honest, to making, or non-scientific remark, because we're always importing cases of measles. And we're seeing always at a low rate. What's happened in the United States and what's happened in Canada is they've spread.
And Australia, I guess this puts us on notice as well. And I know that our numbers are still very low, but, you know, in 2025, there were 121 cases of measles. That's the highest it's ever been since 2019. And we've covered on the show last year multiple times the fact that the childhood vaccination rates have declined from 2020 to 2024. So we're below that 95% golden number of herd immunity in many age groups. And hopefully we're not on the same path as the US, but, I think we need to be cautious.
And remember, this is a virus that can kill children, can kill adults too, and it can also cause a really dreadful condition called subacute sclerosing panencephalitis, a brain-destroying disease secondary to measles.
Still in the US, last year we spoke a lot about claims made by the Trump administration about paracetamol use by pregnant people, potentially increasing the risk of autism and ADHD diagnoses in children. There was a huge amount of confusion and anxiety, despite the fact that peak medical bodies in the US, in Australia, were saying there is no evidence to suggest that pregnant people using paracetamol causes any issues like that in children.
Big study in Sweden, 2.3 million children showing no effects. And this is what happened when the fraudulent research came out many years ago on measles, mumps, rubella vaccines suggesting an autism link. It launched millions of dollars worth of studies, distracted people from what they could have otherwise been doing, which is improving public health, to actually prove what they already had proven before, which is that MMR did not cause autism. And here you've got the same situation, which is now we've got these papers coming out where people are just trying to show in different ways that showing that it doesn't cause a problem in terms of autism. And this study try to correct for some of the criticism that there's been is that when you control for all the environmental factors, there's absolutely no link. And some people said, well, you haven't controlled for all the factors. And in this study, they particularly looked at siblings, brothers and sisters in the same family, to really be able to control for the shared environment that you might grow up in, shared genetics. And when you even allowed for that, there was still no effect of Panadol.
And it's quite significant. So they've included 43 studies in the systematic review, 17 in the meta-analysis. So this is big data and there is no causal link. And we already knew this, but it's just confirming it. And just a reminder that in Australia, this is a Category A medication in pregnancy. Paracetamol is safe and doesn't have any harms for the fetus, for the baby.
The risk is the flu. The risk is COVID. The risk is fever.
Yes. And actually, when Trump did say in 2025 that women should tough it out or not use paracetamol, avoid it, it's actually potentially harmful given that untreated fever, untreated pain may actually have implications for the baby and increase the risk of neurodevelopmental diagnoses. When in fact, it's really quite harmful, suggesting that women shouldn't go for the first line safest treatment if they have a fever or pain in pregnancy.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Health Report. You know what, Priya, I just saw an interesting article in The Atlantic, and, you know, paraphrasing the title, it was, you know, trading dry January for high January. In other words, getting off the alcohol for January. Ooh. Here in Australia, it's dry July. So trading alcohol for putting drops in your drink for the THC.
And I'm saying it on my social media feed. So I'm being flooded by these ads on Instagram to essentially...
Serves right for being having a social media feed.
Or for being in the younger cohort. Is it on your feed, Norman?
No, I tend to get sort of old age homes in my feed.
Well, I'm getting flooded by these and I didn't even know that they're available and I don't quite understand how safe it is. It's being marketed as safe. Not sure.
Well, to help us explain this is Professor Mike Farrell, who is Director of the National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre at the University of New South Wales, an old friend of the Health Report. Welcome back, Mike.
Thank you, Norman.
So what's going on? Is this news to you?
No, it's not news. It's partly what's happened with the expansion of the cannabis industry in the United States, and it's the diversification. But one of the particular things is the 2018 Hemp Farm Bill, which permitted high levels of production of hemp. You can get a small percentage of THC out of it, and that extract of THC has been poured into these soft drinks. And it's now nearly $1 billion industry in the United States.
Is it available here, Michael, in Australia?
To the best of my knowledge, no, definitely not in that way. There may be what you might call medicinal drinks, but that will be different than over-the-counter. In the United States, they're on sale in stalls on the street, in petrol stations, everywhere.
Wow.
So what are they using here? If you're trading off alcohol, well, I mean, you smoke a joint, I suppose, or eat a cash cookie, I don't
know. Have a gummy. The CBD gummies or that sort of stuff would be the type of thing, but you will have to have accessed that through some so-called medicinal route, even though CBD probably over-the-counter.
And THC?
THC remains...
We should just explain here. CBD is cannabidiol, THC is tetrahydrocannabidiol, and that's the psychoactive compound.
Correct. THC is the compound that gives you the bit of a high and also could give you a little edge of anxiety depending on your disposition.
Michael, I just wondered, it feels like it's being marketed as if it's safer to have a beverage with THC in it than to consume alcohol. You know, do you necessarily know what you're getting if you're cracking one of these things into your drinks? Are there potential side effects and harms?
Well, I presume the initial problem might be, without any regulation, that the dosage of THC you get in it could be very variable. And obviously, the lower the dosage, the less side effects you might have from it. And the discussions, if you go on the social media and look at the discussions are about what's the optimal dosage, and it's somewhere per can, about 2.5 to 5 milligrams of THC they're talking about.
But coming to Priya's point, is there harm in this?
I think we don't know yet, would be the answer. There's a number of different ways of thinking about harm. There's the immediate dose exposure.
So that's driving and things like that.
Yeah, well, and driving, it'll be quite an issue for driving if people are taking amounts that they don't know how much they're taking. The issue may not be THC instead of alcohol. It may actually be THC plus alcohol. Mm. And that's actually much more likely to be the combination, and it's more likely to be much more impairing.
Let's look at this phenomenon of dry months. Mm. So dry January, dry July. Do we know anything, first of all, about why people, I mean, they just worry that they're going to get addicted to alcohol? Do we know what the motivation is for those dry months?
Well, this is part of the new sober, sensitive era we live in. So people are, first of all, they're hearing about the risks of alcohol, cancer-related risks and health-related risks, particularly from the World Health Organization message that there is no safe level of alcohol when it comes to cancer risk. And that has influenced, and we're actually seeing reports of fall in levels of consumption of alcohol in the younger generation. We can't explain why yet, but a cultural change appears to be occurring.
There's a recent study that just came out, Michael, in the British Journal of Cancer, suggesting that if we all reduced our alcohol consumption by a litre each year, there would be much fewer cancer-related deaths. So breast cancer in women, liver cancer in men, colorectal cancer deaths. So there is an argument for doing dry something. If you reduce, I know, Norman, you're not a big fan of a dry month, but it appears that there might actually be benefit in it.
Well, the argument is, yes, of course there's benefit in people exerting control and figuring out and having breaks. But the argument is that you need to be more consistent in the behaviour change.
I was going to say, if you have a dry month and then go back to your previous level, you should probably not do yourself much good.
Well, you might...
Because these are averages in that. By the way, it's a Melbourne-based study, but yeah, these are averages.
Yes. I mean, if you look at the studies, what you do see is that the total population consumption of alcohol does not change in dry January, so that you're actually not getting a big population effect.
Right.
But
okay.
Then if we look at that, we know that a small percentage of the heavy drinking population account for 80% of the consumption, and they're unlikely to engage in dry January anyway, or dry July.
But if you're doing a dry month, the whole thing is that you don't necessarily take up THC to get the high instead in your drink, because there are also risks with that.
Well, there's also the question of if you're getting the benefits of abstinence for a month and you're detoxing your body, basically, actually the behavioural component of that, I think, is also important, is that you're learning how to handle some slightly distressing feelings without resorting to a drink.
So you're not self-medicating with THC.
Or if you're switching from alcohol to THC, you're not getting that behavioural change of understanding that you can control things without taking drugs. I mean, one of the things when we look at both alcohol consumption, but we also look at sleep, we want to get the message across to people that the behavior, sleep hygiene, behavioral lifestyle changes are more important than replacing one medication with another medication.
Professor Mike Farrell is director of the National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre at the University of New South Wales.
So I find it interesting, Norman, because Michael has just said replacing alcohol with THC is not the solution and that we need to ideally, if you can, eliminate or not have either of them. And I think that's really...
Tough it out, as Donald Trump would say.
But I think it is easier said than done. And so I wonder if there's something in us actually having a discussion down the track about practical ways to reduce alcohol intake without needing to replace it with anything else. How do you actually do it? I have a lot of older patients who say to me, but Priya, I've had that glass of red every night for several years with my partner. It's part of my wind down ritual. It can be quite a difficult thing to break.
Yeah, I think what Mike was really saying was people self-medicate.
Yes.
For reasons such as anxiety, such as depression. They think it makes them feel better, but actually...
Or sleep issues.
Yeah, and in the long term, it actually doesn't help them. And if you're replacing one drug with another, you're not actually learning to deal with it. But you make a good point. Let's put it on the books for later on in the year.
You're with the Health Report on ABC Radio National. In many states now, breast density is being reported if someone goes and has a breast cancer screening mammogram. But is it necessarily doing women good, or is it generating more confusion and anxiety?
And for people who've never heard of breast density before, it's about, in theory, increasing the risk of actually late detection of breast cancer, or maybe an increased risk of breast cancer in its own right. We'll have that soon. But now to palliative care. Not something that people like thinking about a lot, but we're all going to die, and some of us are going to die of a condition that will be with us for quite some time before we die. And the evidence is that we actually get to palliative care too late. Now, people tend to think that palliative care is just about, you know, that's when they start squirting you with morphine and you're going to die, you know, soon afterwards. It's really a death sentence. And a complete misunderstanding of what palliative care is, which is about symptom control. They're really good at symptom control.
Oh, really good.
And making your life better. Anyway, in the last two or three days, an important study from Victoria has been published looking at when people actually get palliative care. Is it early? Is it late? And what happens to you in terms of your quality of life, early versus late? Is it really worth having it early or not? And the person who was the lead author on the study is Associate Professor Chris Schilling, who's a health economist in the Centre for Palliative Care at the University of Melbourne.
We're trying to understand, for every person who died of cancer in Victoria, what were the rates of access to palliative care and to timely palliative care? And then what was the impact of a person receiving timely palliative care versus someone who only received it later on?
How did you study it?
We put together a really large data set. So we looked at every cancer death in Victoria over the last 5 years, data from the Victorian Cancer Registry. So that's got really detailed information about the patient and their cancer journey and when they were diagnosed, what type of cancer it was and what stage it was. And we linked that with hospitalisation records. And so by putting those two things together, we were then able to investigate those research questions to see, of those people who died with cancer, who were they actually able to access palliative care and at what time point did they access palliative care?
Because one of the things you're combating here is a fear of palliative care, because people believe palliative care is just a death sentence. You know, you only have it just before you die.
That's right. And so one of the big barriers of earlier referral to palliative care is that both patients actually and clinicians have this fear that it indicates that your time is nigh, you know, that all treatment's going to stop and that that's it. That's really not the case. And early palliative care can make such a difference to the way that those last months play out.
So how do you define early palliative care?
In our study, we used a time point of at least 90 days before death.
That's not that early.
No, it's really not.
And I mean, people say that you know, if you're a GP or you're a cancer specialist, you should say to yourself, and in fact, a person with cancer should say to themselves, would it be a big surprise if I died in the next, or this person died in the next 12 months? And if it wouldn't be, that's the trigger for palliative care.
Yeah, that's right. And even some of the latest guidelines are suggesting, you know, much earlier referral to palliative care so that palliative care is brought in alongside treatment for cancer. But it's just not what we're seeing.
So what did you find?
Yeah, what we see is that 7 out of 10 people, Victorians who died from cancer, access palliative care. But the majority of those accessed it really late in the last 24, 48 hours of life.
24, 48 hours?
Yeah. So only 3 in 10 people who access palliative care at least 90 days before death.
Then what you did in the study is looked at the effect on people's lives as to the impact of early palliative care.
So we investigated a whole range of metrics that are used internationally around the quality of care at end of life. And these metrics are things like how many ED visits happened in the last 30 days of life, were there long stay hospitalizations where people are spending extensive time in hospital in the last 30 days of life, and were there aggressive treatments right up until death, things like chemotherapy in the last days of life. And so we went and analysed these metrics for those who had access to early palliative care versus those who only had access to it in the last 24 and 48 hours of life. And what we saw was really significant differences. People who had access to early palliative care had 25% less chance of an ED visit in the last 30 days of life, 30% less chance of a long stay in hospital, almost 50% less chance of a chemotherapy in the last 30 days of life. So really significant and large impact. And on the more positive side, they were almost 50% more likely to have an advanced care plan and almost 2.5 times more likely to die outside an acute hospital bed.
I mean, this study presumably wasn't designed to look at length of life, but other research has shown, I think Australian research has shown, that if you have palliative care, you actually live longer.
Yeah, that's what the data shows. And the data also shows that there's a much higher quality of life.
So you're arguing in this paper that palliative care should be delivered earlier so you get better symptom control, better holistic care. Do we have the resources across Australia to provide that? GPs traditionally, some GPs like delivering palliative care, but they don't get well paid for it. So there's been a decline in GP involvement in palliative care. Do we have the resources?
No. At the specialist palliative care end, the numbers are sitting at about half what we need. And then when we move outside the specialist palliative care physicians and nurses to GPs and clinicians, what we see is that some are really great at offering and palliative care and are really confident, but a whole lot aren't. And that means that palliative care is really left to the specialists in a lot of cases. So across the board, we really aren't resourced and staffed to provide the early palliative care that we really need.
And of course, this paper just deals with people with cancer. I shouldn't have said just, but the palette, if you like, for palliative care is expanded. People with dementia, people with heart failure, people with motor neuron disease. There's a lot of people who benefit from palliative care.
Indeed, COPD, et cetera. And as you say, the data that we see for those who have died of cancer are really those who have had the greatest access to palliative care. What we see in these other diseases is that they've had even less access, which is obviously concerning.
Some people say that really the answer here is not relying on doctors, but nurses and training nurses up to be nurse practitioners who can make their own decisions, prescribe the drugs that need to be prescribed. Is that the answer?
it's one part of the answer, but there needs to be a multifaceted response. The gap between what we've got in terms of supply of workforce, whether that be doctors or nurses or specialists or GPs, is so great that there's not one answer. We need more nurse practitioners providing greater services. We need more specialist palliative care physicians. And we need non-specialists to be trained so that there's a whole lot greater confidence to provide palliative care outside the specialist palliative care environment.
Associate Professor Chris Schilling is a health economist in the Centre for Palliative Care at the University of Melbourne there. And, you know, this is one of the ironies here, Priya, is that there are some GPs who are absolutely fantastic at palliative care, but they penalise themselves financially. It's just, you can't make a living as a GP, remembering you're not on a salary, doing it. It's just wrong.
Yes, and that's where the Medicare and the item numbers and remuneration really, really don't support people necessarily doing what's best practice. But I do think there's a big misconception when it comes to palliative care that it means end of life. But you've hit the nail on the head. It's about symptom control. It's really holistic. It involves often the family and other people around the patient. And if only everybody could be referred earlier. The question is, Norman, though, if we say earlier referral, are there always the services there to actually capture these people if we do refer everyone really early?
Well, as Chris said in the interview, no, there's not. Yeah. But maybe there could be if GPs were prepared to pick up a thing, or practice nurses with a bit of training.
Another one for Medicare to look at.
Yeah, because you've got all this spare time as a GP to just do everything to solve the problems of the healthcare system.
That's right. On ABC Radio National, you're with the Health Report. People might be aware that in several states, so Victoria, New South Wales, South Australia, if you go and have your breast cancer screening mammogram from age 50 every 2 years, you're now getting your breast density reported. That refers to that proportion of fibroglandular tissue relative to fatty tissue in the breast. And of course, if you've got really dense breasts, and we've spoken about this before, it can increase the risk potentially of breast cancer, but also make it more difficult to detect lesions because the breasts are more dense. There's been research done in Australia to look at whether or not it's good for women psychologically to find out this information. Does it make women feel more informed? I spoke with lead author Dr. Brooke Nicol, who's a senior research fellow in the School of Public Health at the University of Sydney, and I asked her whether it's a good thing knowing this information or not.
Yeah, that's a really tricky question. I definitely think there's a lot of pros to finding out your breast density, but I also think there can be some harms or just some things that we're still really unsure of. I think that's where the crux of the issue lies, that it's really good for women to be informed about everything regarding their health, but we also don't really have the evidence or the pathways for what they should do next. So it's a really tricky one, actually.
So you've done this study that's looked at the impact of breast density reporting on women's psychological well-being. What did you find? What were some of the key takeaways?
So we randomized over 2,400 women with dense breasts, and we randomized them to standard care, which was no notification of breast density, which was happening in Breast Screen Queensland, where we undertook this study at the time, compared to notification in two different forms. One was via a hard copy letter or insert, and the other one was video-based information. But in both of those intervention groups, they were told upfront in their screening letter that they had dense breasts. And what we found is that women in those two notified groups were more confused about what to do in regard to their breast health. They also felt more anxious, and interestingly, they did not feel more informed about what to do in regard to their breast health, which was an interesting finding for us because much of the push for breast density notification is to inform women so that they can make decisions about what to do next, go speak with their GP, and potentially consider other screening in addition to mammography.
So really, the groups who found out their breast density didn't actually feel better or more informed is the key takeaway.
Yeah, they didn't feel more informed about what to do with their breast health. And then there were these potentially negative consequences about feeling confused about the information, as well as a little bit more anxious.
So when women get this information, Brooke, it can often mean, as you alluded to, that you go and see your GP, have a chat, and you might either need review with a breast specialist, or you might need additional scanning. Maybe you need a contrast enhanced mammogram, something more specific to look at the breast tissue. I guess the thing is, it's not always feasible for people because it incurs an out-of-pocket cost. They might live in a regional area where that's not really a possibility. If you're reporting on breast density, does the follow-up need to be more accessible or subsidised perhaps? Because a lot of these scans are really expensive.
Absolutely. I think that's kind of the crux of the issue here, is that it's all well and good to tell women about their breast density and give them more information about their breast health. But if there is no equitable pathway for women to then follow, I think that's a really big issue. We know that GPs are stretched, that it's becoming more expensive and harder for the general public to access their GPs. And then if they are able to access them, discuss potential risk factors beyond breast density alone and make the decision that they might want to do something else about that, there is an out-of-pocket cost for that as well. So like you said, going to get an ultrasound or contrast-enhanced mammography or an MRI, those all will incur out-of-pocket costs for women who are at higher risk based on their breast density alone. And that's really problematic, to kind of give this information to women and then you kind of leave them to their own devices about what then to do. It just doesn't make it equitable for all women.
So this has been rolled out, this standard reporting of breast density on screening mammograms has been rolled out in several states. Was there enough knowledge before it was done to know that it was the right move? Because as the horse somewhat bolted now, women are finding out these results. Did we know enough before we started telling people?
It's, again, a really tricky question to answer. I don't think we did know enough. I think that if we're putting a population intervention out there, especially for healthy women, so a public health intervention, that there really should be robust evidence to inform those interventions. And before we undertook our RCT, there was no randomized control trial internationally which looked at how this impacts women and also how it impacts the health and screening services. So that is really why we went a few years ago and started planning this, because there was no robust evidence and it was a really hot topic here in Australia, but also internationally. But all that movement was really driven by, and rightfully so, driven by consumer advocates and other data that was showing that this is an important risk factor for women and that it masks cancer on a screening mammogram. But there was no randomized control trial evidence to inform these psychosocial impacts or health service impacts.
And I guess that's the important part there as well, that dense breasts alone are a potential risk factor for breast cancer, but also can make it more difficult to detect lesions because the tissue is harder to read.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And that is a really important thing for women to be aware of. And it is a really valid reason for wanting this information. But I do think that because we are talking about a screening population, again, which are healthy women going in without disease, that there really does need to be good evidence to inform that population-based intervention. And there was some evidence. There was cross-sectional studies, including some that we had done. There was cross-sectional studies internationally that said, you know, women really want to know this information and would value it. But there was some also mix around harms. So that's why we did go and assess this in an RCT. We're continuing to follow these women. So we've now just collected our 12-month follow-up data, which we're analyzing, and we'll be following them for another year as well. So I think that will be really important to then see what women do in terms of their actions. So whether they do go see GPs, whether they do access supplemental screening such as ultrasound, contrast enhanced, or MRI. You know, there's clear evidence from a number of trials internationally that supplemental screening with ultrasound, MRI, or contrast enhanced will detect more cancers in women with these dense breasts. But those trials also don't have any long-term follow-up. So we don't know what the outcomes in terms of breast cancer mortality, as well as any adverse consequences, such as widening, you know, health inequities.
So you're talking about not just relying on the mammogram alone?
Yeah, so I guess I'm talking about the pathway. If we do recommend women to go for supplemental screening, it still should be noted that they're still gathering evidence on whether those are beneficial long-term for women with dense breasts. We know they find more cancers in these women, but none of the trials have followed women long enough to say whether adding those additional screening modalities actually will reduce breast cancer mortality.
Okay, so you might be picking up cancers with that additional screening that were never going to harm the woman potentially.
Yeah, potentially, and there's a lot of false positives. I mean, the trials, they've been well conducted and they do show this increase in cancer detection, but we just don't have the long-term data yet to show whether they will be beneficial in the long term for these women or whether they're just detecting more cancers.
In terms of how this system could potentially be improved, would it work better potentially as an opt-in system where it's not routine, or does there need to be, as you said before, better access to the follow-on pathway, seeing the GP or having more imaging done? How can this potentially be bettered?
Yeah, I think, like you said before, the horse is kind of bolted. So I think we won't go backwards and change it to an opt-in system at this point. I don't envision that happening. And I think it would be kind of a lot trickier to go that way rather than think forward about the potential pathways for these women, whether women with dense breasts are then given the option to have a further risk assessment within the screening program or outside the screening program. I know there is some work being done in other states trying to look at the feasibility and accessibility of such pathways. And that's really kind of moving towards this next step around risk-based screening. So taking breast density, but also taking other risk factors such as a woman's family history, their genetics, their BMI, and then seeing an overall risk picture and seeing what they may need to do next. But it's really about that burden of then what does a GP do? Because we know from studies that they don't feel well supported on this topic, that the guidance is quite limited. There is new guidance now in Australia, came out at the end of November, but it still doesn't kind of fix the issue around equity for these women about further pathways.
That was Dr. Brooke Nicol, who's a senior research fellow in the School of Public Health at the University of Sydney.
So what are you going to say next to the next patient who comes in saying, I've been told I've got dense breasts?
So,
Dr.
Norman,
Alexander,
may I have the soapbox for a moment? Because this is, as Brooke
haven't
mentioned...
Haven't you got it all the time? I mean, I just stand in the park...
I often have to elbow you off.
Looking up at you, waiting for you to come on. Anyway, carry on.
I often have to elbow you off, I feel. But look, this is, I feel, a conundrum, as Brooke mentioned, where I've had a patient in their 40s recently come in. She's a busy mother of three children. She has other health diagnoses and she has come back with seriously dense breasts. I've involved a breast surgeon who costs money, who has suggested really quite frequent specialised imaging, which again costs money. And the patient turned to me, Norman, and said, Priya, what's the point of me knowing my breast density? I just feel more anxious. I can't afford the scans that I need. I can't afford this breast surgeon. This has just generated more anxiety for me and more of a headache. Did I need to know?
And to be fair, if the system is going to tell you that you've got breast density, the system needs to provide heavily subsidised or free diagnostics.
Yes, and if you've got extremely dense breasts, that BI-RADS C or D, really dense breasts, and you need specialised imaging, I think that there needs to be subsidy or funding and better access for that. Because at the moment, I think there are a lot of people really struggling to navigate the system. And as a GP, it is a difficult area to navigate and have these discussions when there's actually a lot of other stuff that we're trying to do as well.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Health Report. So now I've got you off your soapbox, Priya, what's in the mailbag?
Last year we did a call out for anyone who is using AI for health reasons. So we asked people to write in with their experiences, their thoughts. And we will be digging into this further in the coming weeks and months, but we've had huge numbers of responses and we're very grateful for that. But if you are someone who's just found out about it and you have had an experience or thoughts about it or expertise in the area, please write in to us because we're very interested to hear from you.
And fellow GP of yours, Andrew, is he a friend of yours, has written in?
We're all friends. We're all friends, Norman. So Andrew says, has written in regarding the new TGA guidelines on vitamin B6 supplements, which we discussed in great detail last year, of course.
And frustratingly, because they're not going to come in until the middle of next year.
That's right.
For God's sake.
You were upset about it then and you're still upset about it.
Can't get off
but
it.
People
He's
might
upset
recall,
about it too.
He is. People, just to give you some context, B6 toxicity has been an issue. People are taking more in their supplements than what they realise and the TGA placed more regulations around them. Andrew wrote in and said that the maximum amount of B6 in an off-the-shelf supplement will be 50 milligrams. Higher doses will require a prescription. Having had an interest in peripheral neuropathy for several years, Andrew noted that doses in supplements are most often at 25 or 50 milligrams per capsule and furthermore are still added to many magnesium supplements. The new regulations seem to not affect the supplement industry at all.
Good on you, Andrew.
Yeah. And once the publicity surrounding B6 has settled down, I'm sure I will see patients with symptoms suggestive of peripheral neuropathy who will continue to have excessive B6 on blood testing. In my whole career as a GP, I have never seen a case of neuropathy due to B6 deficiency, so not having enough. Indeed, I have never seen a low B6 level on blood testing. So I guess what Andrew was saying is that nothing's really going to change potentially.
Yeah, and he comments that when you've got somebody who's got a good reason for having a peripheral neuropathy, there's something sometimes taking supplements that could make it worse.
Correct, because there's basics in a lot of different things.
And Sarah writes in, Hi, Norman and team. I just wanted to reach out and say thank you for the work you're doing. Mid last year, I started having some mild symptoms and changes in bowel habits. I was worried, but tried to remind myself that it was probably fine because I'm a fit and healthy 44-year-old. I've been vegan for 20 years, eat mostly whole foods, exercise, I don't smoke, and I don't drink to excess. However, you'd been talking about increased rates of cancer in young people on the show. We did a Four Corners on it as well. And I went to my doctor and she took my symptoms seriously, but also assured me the chances of it being anything serious were low as my symptoms were few and mild. And I was put on the waiting list for a colonoscopy. Fast forward a few months and a significant bleed took me to the hospital before the colonoscopy was scheduled. 2 days later, I was diagnosed with stage 4 bowel cancer that had spread to my liver. I'm starting chemo on Tuesday, and I want to thank you because your reporting made me take my health seriously. It made me book those appointments and try to advocate for myself. The wheels of the public system turn slowly, and sometimes things aren't found in time. I hope it's not too late for me, but for many other people listening and watching, I know it won't be. Also, I just want to say that I feel empowered and calmed by the knowledge I've gained from the reporting. When the diagnosis came, I was able to stay pretty calm and face it. I don't blame myself or wonder why me. I think, why not me? 15,000 people get my cancer every year in Australia, and every one of those cases is a person just like me. Warm regards, Sarah. Mm.
Thank you for sharing that, Sarah, and we are sending you loads of good energy and we hope you do well.
And I think that the comment buried in that, on Sarah's story, is advocating for yourself. You really should not feel embarrassed about advocating for yourself when you feel something's wrong, to push it and not be calmed or settled by reassurance when you feel in yourself there is something wrong. Keep pushing it and the system will move for you and your GP will move things for you too. So get out there and politely but firmly advocate for yourself.
Agree wholeheartedly with that. We really appreciate your emails. So please write in to us at healthreport@abc.net.au.
And don't forget our sister podcast, What's That Rash, where this week we test the proposition that you should never retire.
I'm not for that one, but you might be. Let's see.
Yeah, back to your veggie garden.
See you next week.
See you then.